Good morning. Good morning. We are here in the matter of Taylor v. State, case number 65388. Mr. Drummond, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. My name is Craig Drummond, representing the appellant in this matter. I'd request to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal in this case.
And you are aware, sir, that the time that you see in front of you is the full time, so that's running down, it's running down.
Yes, Your Honor. November 18, 2010, Ms. Chenault, a grandmother, is at her house, at her apartment, cooking chicken. She's at the stove, focused on frying chicken. During that morning, and these are the morning hours, her grandson is dropped off by the boyfriend of her daughter. Son is placed in the room. She goes back to frying chicken. The boyfriend places a bag, and the boyfriend is the victim in this case, Mr. Pearson, places a bag atop the refrigerator and tells Ms. Chenault, I'll be back later with some acquaintances. Sometime later, he comes to the door, knocks on the door. Ms. Chenault answers it. Mr. Pearson and two other individuals enter the apartment complex, enter the apartment. Ms. Chenault does not look at them very well. She momentarily sees them, closes the door, and goes back and focuses on frying her chicken. She's tired. It's early in the morning. She's just returned from a funeral from her grandmother and learned that her great aunt had also died. This is her focus that morning on the food and putting her grandson in a room so that her grandson can go to sleep. These two men enter. She does not see them well, does not focus on them. At some point in time, one of the gentlemen begins walking around the apartment asking who is there. She approaches him and says, don't go in that room. The only person there is my grandson. Momentarily looks at him, only a glance, according to her. She goes back to the kitchen, working on her chicken. At some point in time later, there's an oral conversation.
There's a suggestion in the state's brief that when she had this exchange, the gentleman was, and I use the term advisedly, carrying a gun and that it was visible. Did I misread that?
Now, she does, there is some testimony, and there's actually some debate as to some of these facts, but there is some testimony that she does observe a gun on the individual.
Okay.
Regarding any of the faces.
Before this exchange about don't go in that room.
Yes, Your Honor. There is some discussion about that she claims that, well, at some point in time, she did see a gun on the individual. Regarding any faces, the testimony was glance or momentarily. And glance are her words that she used during the grand jury. An oral exchange between these two individuals and Mr. Pearson occurs. She's not watching it.
The man who wanted to go into the grandson's room, or she thought he did, was the defendant in this case?
Well, that's the state's position, that individual is Mr.
And the testimony's mixed on that?
But our position is it's not him. But the position of the state seems to be that the man who gets up and walks through that bedroom or walking around the apartment is, in fact, Mr. Taylor.
And supposedly the man that she later identified.
Correct, Your Honor, yes. Okay. At some point in time, this oral conversation occurs. It gets heated. They talk about the drug transaction. Ms. Chenault overhears the conversation. There's discussion about, I'm taking these drugs with me. I'm not paying you. Word to that effect. Shots are fired. Mr. Pearson is shot dead. The two individuals immediately leave. The police are called. The police come and notice a phone upon Mr. Pearson, and they immediately begin doing an investigation to try to figure out who these two other gentlemen were. These two other gentlemen were not known to Ms. Chenault. She had not seen them before. She did not know their names. During this exchange, during this investigation, as they're looking through the phone, they make a determination that there's a Mr. D. They determine that they think this Mr. D, through talking with other witnesses, could in fact be Donald Taylor. They go interview some girlfriends, they interview some other individuals to come to this conclusion. Later that night, they take Mr. Taylor into custody. They place him in a squad car. They drive him to a parking lot. There they also, other officers go and get Ms. Chenault. They tell her, we have a suspect. Can you see if you can identify this suspect?
Is that what they tell her?
Where's the effect of, we believe we have a suspect.
So they didn't take him to the police station and put him in a lineup or do what they call a six-pack photo lineup, too? That's the other way it's usually done?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There were a number of options they could have done. They did not choose to do any of them. They chose to drive him essentially to a parking lot. They chose to essentially put the lights on him in the squad car and drive Ms. Chenault up to the area. He is the only one standing there. There are no other suspects that they're claiming we have. Is it this guy or that guy or whoever it may be? They're saying, we believe we have a suspect. Can you identify him? They drive up. Ms. Chenault states she cannot identify him, is what she tells the officer. She's not sure it's him. There's some discussion about whether his face is different or his body type is different. Either way, she's not sure. So much she's not sure that the officer says they drive closer. They actually get closer to him, and he asks her again, can you identify him? Her response are words to the effect of, I'm not positive that's him. Either way, if it's I'm not positive or I'm not sure, it's a little unclear in the record, but either way, we know for a fact she doesn't say that's him, she doesn't say I'm certain, she doesn't say I'm 100%. During the investigation, the police...
And how long after hours, how many hours after the initial encounter in the apartment does this parking lot encounter occur?
The initial, we believe that the initial altercation occurs sometime around 3 in the morning, sometime around that time frame, early hours in the morning. My understanding is the focus with the police lights on this individual occurs somewhere around 11 o'clock that night. So much later in the evening, but it is still all occurring on November 18, 2010.
Okay.
But more than 8 hours later, for sure, that it's occurring. Then they have Mr. Taylor, and they began trying to figure out if they can link Mr. Taylor to this incident, more so than this sort of, hey, I think I can identify this person, or that may be him, but I'm not sure. They continue to do their investigation. During that time, they also take a photograph.
Well, his phone number was in the decedent's cell phone, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's how they originally, by trying to figure out who this D was and by talking to the victim's girlfriend, they do try to figure out that they think that that is, in fact, Mr. Taylor, and that's how they go get him. And they find an address, okay. And then they set up surveillance. That's how they, in fact, found him. During this time, police officers also take a photograph, either I think from a computer screen, of Mr. Taylor, and they text it to Ms. Chenault's daughter. They text it to the victim's girlfriend, and they say, hey, this D person we're trying to figure out and trying to see who this is that Donald Taylor? Is that the D person you know about? And because she had met him at a party, she says yes. But what's very interesting is what she does next is she shows, without police being there, she shows that photograph to her mother. At that point in time, Ms. Chenault tells her daughter, oh, yes, words the effect of, I'm now 100% sure that's the man who came in the apartment. At no point in time prior to being shown that photograph of Donald Taylor, that photograph of one person that law enforcement provided her daughter, was she ever sure who that individual was. And it was only at that point in time, after being shown that photograph, that now miraculously she's able to 100% ID this person.
Because she had previously identified him in the illuminated lineup as well as at the police station, correct?
She had limited identification on her. Her words are, I'm not positive that's him. And that's what the officer also testified about at the grand jury, that she was not positive that was
him. But she didn't identify him at the police station. It was just in the parking lot that there was any identification.
The only identification done with law enforcement was where he is the only one there, the lights are shining on him, she has to approach again, and then she says, I'm not positive.
What other evidence did the state present to the jury to sustain their burden of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt besides the ID?
And there's really two parts, and I could focus on the next part. The next part has to do with the cellular phone data. And what happened is on November 18th, once they figure out that this phone, law enforcement believes is Mr. Taylor, they try to see what other information they can gather to tie Mr. Taylor to this limited eyewitness identification. Somehow, they obtain all of Mr. Taylor's cellular phone data. They obtain tracking data, they obtain bills, they obtain information showing which cell phone tower would ping. And I say somehow. The record that by the state implements that they had a subpoena.
Yeah.
There was no subpoena presented to the defense. It's in some of the motion practice where the defense is saying we cannot find a subpoena. The state represents that they had a subpoena. We don't know who issued the subpoena. We don't know who signed the subpoena.
And it's not in the record.
It's not in the record. The state also did not provide a subpoena in any appendix, and there is some briefing that was done at the district court where, again, the public defender at that time said that he couldn't see a subpoena. Somehow they get this data. What we do know is they did not get the data on November 18, 2010 with a court order. We know that for sure. And why is that important? I'll get to that in a minute on why I guess that is important. But they get this data on November 18th. They begin trying to see if they can pinpoint where Mr. Taylor was. Was he in the vicinity? And they do that through, as this court I'm sure is aware, by trying to see which cell phone tower would come onto his phone when he was in different locations.
Well, normally, is that obtained from, say, through a search warrant or through a subpoena?
It should be obtained, Your Honor, through a search, through an actual, it's simply just called a warrant or a court order, and that court order is done through the SCA, the Stored Communications Act, and that is the one federal law that provides clear guidance on how law enforcement is supposed to get this cellular phone information. And in fact, it's a 1985, 1986 federal law that outlines a very clear approach that all that has to do, law enforcement has to contact a magistrate or a judge, they present the facts, and they have to show essentially a reasonableness. It's actually a little less standard than probable cause, as we can get to that in a minute as far as how the courts have interpreted it, but it's a federal law that says you have to present this reasonableness, and then the magistrate or the judge authorizes it. That is what the law requires. And in fact, some of the cases cited by the state where they're talking about, hey, we can get this data, it's not protected, we don't necessarily need a court order. If you look at those cases, and if you look at the case law, those federal cases all had to deal with where that data was properly obtained through the Stored Communications Act. Those cases had to do with whether that act itself was constitutional, whether the act that, where it didn't require probable cause, it said reasonableness, whether that was constitutional. But in those cases, those courts all said, or those fact patterns are almost all where law enforcement went and got the order and then went to the subscriber. Here, we have either some sort of a subpoena, and again, we don't know what kind of subpoena, or however they got it, we know it wasn't through the Stored Communications Act. What's interesting about this is on November 23rd, this happens November 18th, November 23rd, after they already have all this data, they go to law enforcement and they ask the FBI to go get this order. They actually go, and it's appendix page 86, footnote 2. They admit that they went then, well after the event, and got a court order, and then went and got all the data. Seemingly in a way to try to protect this issue where they got all this protected information. And where I say it's protected information, it's protected because Congress protected it. Congress, by setting up the Stored Communications Act, protected it and gave a process by which law enforcement was supposed to go through to get it. In this case, by obtaining that data on November 18th, and that is the only other strong evidence that ties my client anywhere near this scene that they used in this case. It's our position that it should have been suppressed. It was not properly obtained. It was not obtained through a court order, and this getting it on November 23rd, 2010, doesn't do anything to cure it. If there are no questions, I'll wait for my rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. On behalf of the state, counsel, I have a couple of preliminary questions. I'm concerned, although Mr. Sherman didn't get to address it, the allegations regarding prosecutorial misconduct. And there are two things that I am particularly concerned about. Number one is the display of the word guilty across the defendant's picture in closing arguments. I'd like to know why that is any different than Waters, notwithstanding the distinction between opening and closing. And finally, I would like to also know about the comments made by the prosecutor in this case, in closing arguments, where it appears that he suggests Mr. Taylor was the only person in the room who could fill in the gaps. Does that imply his guilt, and is that proper?
Good morning. May it please the court. Nell Christensen for the state. Counsel, good morning. I will address that first, and then I'll get to some of the ones that Mr. Drummond brought up. This case is distinguishable from Waters, especially on the fact that Waters was opening statement. And in that opinion, in the analysis portion of the opinion, this court began with the presumption of innocence and then outlining what opening statement is. In opening statement, obviously, there is no place for argument. It's an outline of what the case will show. And so Waters is very distinguishable on that element. With regards to this case, which it was in closing argument. There are cases from this court and across this country that talk about personal opinion, and Dominguez, Collins, Green are all cases from this court in which this court has stated that statements that tend to show opinion, knowledge, personal beliefs of the prosecutor when used as deductions or reasonable inferences from the evidence is absolutely proper and not objectionable. And so in this case, that's exactly when you take in the complete context what my closing argument was. It was facts, the evidence that had been before the jury, and then reasonable inferences and deductions therefrom. And one of the main things, one of the main arguments that I made with regards to evidence of guilt was the defendant's conduct before and after the crimes, including a substantial amount of evidence we had from his girlfriend as to how he was acting after the crimes, and statements he had made to her when he finally came into contact with her, saying things like, I can't tell you what happened, but it's all bad, babe, I might have to go to California, and acting suspiciously and paranoid. And so that was one of the main things that I talked about in closing argument, is you can tell that he is conscious of his own guilt. And based on that and all of the other evidence that the state has put forth, that this, the jury could infer from this that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in this case. And so I think you have to take the entire context of the argument and what arguments that I was making at the time that that word was put on the slide. Also, in Waters, it was objected to below. And here, there's a plain error analysis. It wasn't objected to. And despite appellant's reply where he says that harmless error should apply to unpreserved objections, that's just not the case. This court has recently stated that in Martino Rellin, that even unpreserved errors are even of constitutional dimension, are plain error review, not harmless error. So there's a difference there. Additionally, when we look at whether the error was plain, and of course it's our position that there was no error, but when we look to whether it was plain, here it wasn't obvious. Waters had not come out yet. So there wasn't any specific case in the landscape in Nevada that went to this issue. And that's evident from this court's opinion in Waters, where you went to other jurisdictions, other states, to look for language and analysis in this matter. And so, you know, it wasn't objected to. The district court, is Judge Barker, who's very conscientious, he didn't make a comment about it. It wasn't plain. But also, I think one of the main arguments is it wasn't prejudicial. It wasn't something that infected the verdict at all. It was just the same argument that I had been making during argument the entire time, that here's all the evidence, here are the deductions you can make therefrom. Defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in this case. I also think it's important to clarify, because Glassman is a case which you considered in Waters. Glassman is very distinguishable from this case. In that case, there were a lot of allegations of different things that the prosecutor did, one of which was he had used, or she, I'm not sure, had used the word guilty three times on the slide. One, guilty, in red, went diagonal across the appellant's face. One went the other way, diagonal, and it X'd out the appellant's face, and then underneath there it said the word guilty again in red. And that, there was no legitimate explanation for why it would have to X out the appellant's face. So all in all, I believe that this is not a case in which this was error, much less reversible error. I do want to answer, especially when talking about why it is an error, your question, Justice Gibbons, regarding the evidence that we had in this case, the plethora of evidence that we had in this case. In this case, one of the things that we had that showed identity was the decedent's girlfriend, Tania Haddon. She had testified that, you know, she lived with the decedent. She knew about his plans to do this drug deal. She knew the defendant, Donald Taylor. And she was able to testify as to the victim's statements of future intent. And she testified that his plan was, they'd been planning it for a few days with Dee, his plan was to drop off Chimchi, the 3-year-old son, at the grandma's house, do the drug deal with Dee, and then go to work. She knew a lot of details about the drug deal. And so she put Donald Taylor, at the beginning of the investigation, on the radar of the detectives as well. And that was very strong evidence that whoever was going to do this drug deal was the one who did the murder, and Dee was the one who was going to do this drug deal. And she identified that photograph as Donald Taylor. Additionally, we had a lot of phone evidence in this case, apart from the historical cell phone data. We had done search warrants to actually get into the specific content of text messages. So we had the victim's phone and the defendant's phone downloaded. That included text message content, images, calls.
Did you obtain a search warrant before you got this data on this
yes,
phone?
Yes, before they searched the phone itself and downloaded all of that information from the phone.
But
and
you got its location on the cell towers via subpoena prior to issuance of the search warrant, or am I mistaken in that?
Yes, the search warrant had nothing to do with the cell tower records.
Right.
The cell tower records, as Mr. Drummond states, there was a court order. It was FBI agent Scott Hendricks.
That's the 1123 order, but his point was that was obtained prior to 1123 pursuant to subpoena. Is that correct or not correct?
That is correct, and that was FBI agent Hendricks as well. He was working with Metro. Metro actually got the number from the victim's phone and asked Scott Hendricks, the FBI agent, to get any information that he could. And so he did the equivalent of the standard articulated in 18 U.S.C. 2703D, which was to get the specific and articulable facts to show this is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation, to get the information. And then his practice at the time was to do confirming court orders. And so days later, he did a confirming court order. And that is what is the appellant referred to in the record. It's actually in the record in a couple different points when they talk about that order.
But before that court order, what was there?
There was a subpoena in which...
And do we have that in the record?
The actual subpoena, we do not. The order...
Who got it and from whom and where?
My belief is, and I'm not sure if this is, if I can show this.
Yeah, if you're arguing outside the record, then don't. But
okay,
does the record tell me who applied for that subpoena, who issued it?
It's argued at in the motion work, okay. pre-trial, and it is stated there that Scott Hendricks was the one who obtained that and then did the confirming court order. So that is actually in the record.
And he's the FBI guy.
Yes.
So was that subpoena issued by a federal district court?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if it was issued by a federal district court.
Well, I'm just curious why the police, if they wanted all this information, they could have called the judge on the phone. The judge could have authorized a telephonic search warrant, signed a search warrant later after the telephonic warrant was entered, and they could go get all this data. This federal part of it's kind of got me baffled because I guess we're not that familiar with how it
yeah.
works over there.
And some of the cases that are cited in the briefs very well outline this. The Fifth Circuit case that is cited, I believe it's cited by the appellant actually, is squarely on this. It gives a very good description, a thorough description of this. It's a 2013 case. The FBI agent was acting pursuant to that Stored Communications Act. And what the standard was at the time, it did not require a search warrant. The statute stated it did not require a search warrant. So even when you look at cases, and the vast majority of cases actually come down on our side on this, finding that this is third-party doctrine, the Fourth Amendment does not apply. If you look at the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, they've come down on this, the Third Circuit, the U.S. District Courts and the Ninth Circuit are all coming down on that side as well.
How about the Ninth Circuit itself?
Ninth Circuit hasn't decided it, but in the opinions that are done in the U.S. District Courts of the Ninth Circuit, they expect the Ninth Circuit to come down on this side of it as well. And so one of those cases is U.S. v. Dorsey. It's pretty recent. That has a very good summary
What's
of the
name of that
area.
Case?
I'm sorry?
What's the case name again?
Dorsey, D-O-R-S-E-Y. That has a very good summary of the cases recently. And I would also point out that even cases that come down on the opposite side find that our officers and detectives acting in doing this actually it's found not to be suppressed because it's a reasonable reliance on statute. And so even any case that the appellant could cite that would say this isn't third-party doctrine, they all come in the end to the same conclusion, which is, but at the time, this is what it looked like, and they relied on that statute in doing it this way, and so it wouldn't be suppressed. The cases that the appellant cites in this area, however, importantly, I need to point this out, are some of them are based on state law. It isn't the same as our state law, so he cites a New Jersey case and a Massachusetts case. They, in those states, have already given a different level of protection to their constituents. And in State v. Lloyd, in this court stated, we are on par with the U.S. Supreme Court with regards to our Fourth Amendment protections. So those cases are distinguishable because of the different law that they're going by. The 11th Circuit case, Mr. Drummond and I talked about this beforehand, it's been vacated. They've withdrawn it. And so that can't be relied upon. I would note that they actually didn't suppress it because of the reasonable reliance by the officers on the statute. And then he cites a Northern District of Illinois case. And this is very important because it's different than what we had in this case. We have historical records. In this case, literally what they're complaining about, the one piece of evidence that they're complaining about here, is that there were two phone calls that the victim and the appellant had minutes before the appellant arrived and the murder took place. And during those two phone calls, Sprint could tell us that the cell tower that they were using to service and to connect those calls was located 2.5 miles from the crime scene. So we could literally put the appellant within a several square mile area. Obviously, it's evidence that we want to present. It's in the general area of the Las Vegas Valley that is where the crime scene was, but it's not a slam dunk piece of evidence. It's not a smoking gun. When we're talking about historical records, we're talking about third-party records, where they're keeping those for their business purposes, apart from any request of the government to keep those. And then later, the government goes in and asks them to provide these records that they keep in their ordinary course of their business. It's different when we're talking about prospective records, and that's what's outlined in the Northern District of Illinois case. And so the appellant actually states, oh, the vast majority of courts come down finding this to be a Fourth Amendment violation. Absolutely not true. That case stands for prospective records, and the state agrees probable cause is necessary for prospective records. That's not the third-party doctrine, because the state is essentially saying, phone company, you are ordered for the next 30 days to provide us every 5 minutes with the location of where this phone is, as far as you know. So that's at the government's behest.
And I ask you this, in the interest of time, Mr. Drummond's argued that the identification was unduly suggestive in the back of the police car. It seems a little shaky here how that was done. Why wouldn't you, the police have brought the witness to the Metro's offices and showed either a photo six-pack lineup or a stand-up ID in the police station?
One thing I really need to point out on this issue, and I wish I had a little bit more time, was the argument that he just made, and Mr. Drummond, I know isn't doing this on purpose, but he's misstating the record. I was trial counsel, so I have a little bit better understanding of the facts. In answer to your question, Justice Pickering, this was done, the murder was at 2:30 p.m., and she was brought to the parking lot where they had stopped the defendant sometime after 11 o'clock, but before midnight. So it was 8 hours approximately later where this occurred. And the victim had told, or the Angela Chenault had told the detectives during their interview of her just earlier that day, that afternoon, I can identify him if I see him again. I got a good look at him. And so when they stop him, they have countervailing policy considerations, is the term that's used in the case law. They want to preserve a possible identification if it's because it's still fresh in her mind. They have the policy of, at this point they don't have that much. They want to let him go and go look for the real guy if they get her to say, absolutely, that's not the guy. So those are the considerations that they have at that time that justify it. I'm almost out of time, but I also want to point out, Angela, I want you to read the record with regards to Angela Chenault if you believe that she only got a glance at these guys. Throughout the trial and now today, the appellant continues to say she only got a glance. That was one word she used describing one moment of the several minutes that she's with these guys. She gets a glance at them when she first opens the door and lets these guys in and sees there's two guys, and then she goes back to cooking her chicken. Then she starts to kind of pay attention to them in the house and realizes these guys have guns. And her degree of attention is heightened, and she starts watching what's happening. And that's when she sees Donald Taylor walk over to where her grandson is, and she gets between Donald Taylor and the door, and they have a confrontation. And he says, I want to know who's in here, and she says, It's just me and my grandson. There's no reason for you to go in that door. And this is several seconds where they are face-to-face. She testified inches away from one another, and they're approximately the same height, where she is looking at this guy's face. Then, if you read the record, she can describe in detail every move that appellant makes in her apartment after that. Of course, her interest is piqued. These guys are in there with guns. She knows where he's standing when he says certain things. She even describes at the point when he's patting down the victim, he gets to the right side of the waistband of the victim. And that's when the victim goes for his gun and the gunshots go off. So if you read the record, you'll see she can testify extensively as to this conduct. And she had a great opportunity to see him. So later at the show-up, when she says, I recognize his face. At the crime scene, he was wearing tight clothing. Now he's wearing baggy clothing. I don't know. But she tells the detective, I recognize his face. The detective in the record on pages 19 and pages 1079 and 1080 testifies as to what he told her on the way to the show-up.
Ms. Christensen, you are beyond your time, and so I'm going to ask you to make
a concluding statement. Okay. I wish that I would have had more time to describe all the evidence that we had in this case. We had an extreme amount of evidence of identification in this case, extreme amounts via the phone records that we talked about, via the witnesses. In this case, the state of Nevada's position is there was no error, as alleged by the appellant, but if it was, it still is not reversible error. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Drummond, I'll add a minute of time to your rebuttal time.
And Mr. Drummond, I know you've got a lot to talk about here, so my question now at this stage after hearing from the state is the jury heard all this evidence. The state had the burden of proving their case beyond a reasonable doubt. What is it that, why should we ignore the jury's verdict? Shouldn't we give them deference? And tell me why not.
Your Honor, if the jury had heard properly admitted evidence throughout the trial, then certainly we should give great deference to what that jury has decided. However, where a jury hears evidence of an eyewitness identification that is completely tainted in not one way, but two ways. It's not often that a defense counsel come before this court and say, listen, this identification wasn't just one that was bad, one that was no good. This was two. This was first the issue with 8 hours later, and I certainly will defer as far as the matter of the record to this counsel of the state because I was not trial counsel on this, and I think I did look at it again. It was 2 o'clock, Your Honor. Sorry about that. And then 11 p.m. That night, so it was about 8 hours on the show-up. But there really was no reason for this, them not taking her down to the station and not putting together folks. They can do it very, very quickly with folks they have down there and put this together. What they chose to do is drive her to one location, say, we believe we have a suspect. And I'm not claiming they said, we believe this is the suspect. They said, this is a suspect.
Well, her comment is the police are trying to rule him out as well. I mean, that may have been part of the reason while it was fresh in her mind. What's your thoughts about that?
Doubtful, because they're going around, and at this time they've already been collecting cell phone data. They admit that they've received all this cell phone data on November 18th. As counsel claimed, they're interviewing a girlfriend. They're interviewing all other individuals. It's highly doubtful that they're trying to rule him out at this point in time. More likely that they're trying to rule him in for sure in the case, and instead of doing it the proper way to fully protect the record, they feel like they can do it expediently without really getting anything that's very fair to my client. And so instead they shine the light on him, and even then Ms. Chenault is unable to identify him, and they have to pull even closer, and even then unable to identify him. And regarding the record, if you are going to go back and take a look at it, I think it's important to take a look at Ms. Chenault and the detective's grand jury transcript. And the key pages are page 17 and 19 of the appellant appendix. Why is that important? Because that's the first time we really have a recordation of exactly how this went down. We have a recordation of exactly what the officer remembers. We have a recordation from Ms. Chenault herself, who testified as to how uncertain she was, and the officer in his testimony confirming that I had her look again, she wasn't positive. That's important because it's nice to have something, as we all know, a year later or however long later at trial, after everybody's been met with and understandably all sides are prepped for trial, it's nice to say, well, we've cleaned it up. But if we really want to look at the most facts closest in time, it's that grand jury testimony where the officer admits she was not positive. And then when we have the issue later with her being provided by her own daughter that picture, wow, because then she's amazingly positive. That should not have gone in front of the jury. That was improper evidence to present to that jury, because that jury is going to be left with her on the stand saying, I'm 100% positive. That's a problem. That is evidence that should not have been presented. And then we jump over to the other evidence, which is the cell phone.
Was that objected to, by the way?
And I believe it was. There was actually motion practice on it. So there was significant motion practice to try to suppress all of that pretrial, and those motions were denied. So they actually brought up that
trial. So it's been preserved.
It has been preserved, I believe, Your Honor, yes.
But you still would have had the phone call to the decedent's cell phone right before the crime, and the Hillman declaration of future intent that there was going to be this drug deal to the daughter, and then the daughter's identification of D. Could you comment where I'm going? Harmless error?
Certainly we don't believe that is enough. We don't believe that they're going to have one conversation that they may have a deal in the future where the daughter wasn't there. The daughter didn't see Mr. Taylor, didn't show up, didn't know if Mr. Taylor himself would show up. If I can just have 1 minute to close out on the school communications act. The state, I think, conceded that they did not have a court order. They don't have the subpoena. We don't know how they got it. They cited the case of Davis that we cited, and that is 11th Circuit case. And on May of this year, after all the briefing, it was en banc reconsidered. But that is a very, very important case, because what that case talks about is the Stored Communications Act's protections. And that act says it has to be a court order, and it outlines that this protection is more than a subpoena. And it actually is relying on the deference of the Congress by passing that law to say, listen, if they follow that law, we're going to find it's constitutional. We're going to find the standard and that law is fine, but they still have to have a court order. They didn't have it here. And saying that that was the office policy at the time or something to that effect.
I think counsel was saying that the court order they got was an after-the-fact thing. I think analogizing it to like a telephonic search warrant. Tell me why you think that's not the case.
If they would have had a telephonic search warrant, sure. If they would have called a federal judge and said, hey, on November 18th, and said, hey, we need this information. We want your ability. We want an oral ability to go get it. And again, they've got an FBI agent, so they easily have access to these judges in the U.S. Attorney's Office, obviously. So there's no issue where they couldn't access this. If they would have done that, and then on November 23rd, said, hey, Judge, can you sign this order, Your Honor, can you sign this order documenting this call, which does happen, that's fine. They didn't do that. They issued some subpoena from some jurisdiction we don't know about. Certainly a federal court wouldn't be issuing a subpoena when they know that the law requires a court order, and it did back then, too. And the Davis case that I cite deals with a fact pattern in 2010. So it's the exact same time frame that this case went out. And when you've got a federal agent involved, the one who's actually getting those records, one would assume that they should follow the law. And that law gives protections for a reason, and we ask that the court enforce those reasons. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments here today. The matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.